Next up is Sue Sinclair, who's a relatively recent transplant to Montreal. Now lives here and works here, and hopefully will stay here for a long time. So a Sinclair poem, a Sue Sinclair poem, and a Dave McGimsey poem share this thing that hearsay is true. They're read by people who are not poets, but more than a lot of Canadian poets out there. A friend of mine who worked at a bookshop in Toronto told me that of all Canadian poets not named Leonard Cohen, Sue Sinclair was the most in demand among those who seemed to him simply in search of poetry, which in that old-fashioned way simply spoke to them. And actually, in the fall at a party, I witnessed a woman who worked in the theater become weirdly tongue-tied when she learned that this person here in the kitchen was Sue Sinclair, the poet. It was weird, because I imagine that thing happening one time in Russia or in Europe, but probably not in Canada. If Sinclair's gods are, as she says, Thomas Tranströmer and Charles Wright, her patron saint, I think, is probably Rilke, whom, in my opinion, she often outdoes. Like Rilke, her poems are not shouted from the rooftops. I'd even suggest that they don't really belong in a room of this size with this many people listening. To paraphrase what William James said about religion, a Sinclair poem is evidence of what one does in their solitude. The world that exists in them is the world that will exist when all of us are gone. So, here's Sue. Thank you.
Those are really nice introductions, Darren. Thank you. Outdoing Rilke is a little over the top, but I'll take it. I also think that you should all take a moment and just be grateful that you are not the ones who are trying to follow Dave McGimsey at the moment. I thought I'd start off with a poem. I've got pages and they're flying in the fan here. I thought I'd start off with a poem that I wrote last winter, just because it was in deep winter, which seems to be what we're in now. So it also mentions Nietzsche, and there's a line of his in it, which is, "Forgive me, my friends, I have ventured to paint my happiness on the wall." So when that shows up, that's him. And it's called Poem for Nietzsche's Eyes. My office was once a girl's room. A little swallow, cut from a mirror, is still glued to the wall. At night, in the window's doubled panes, I can see the swallow and a twin flying in perfect formation, steadily into the darkness. I'm thinking now of Nietzsche, of 1 minute and 16 seconds of snowy footage, played and replayed. His huge, steady 19th century eyes looming from a sickbed in Weimar, indifferent to the aphrodisiacal light that fell into the room. Forgive me, my friends. I have ventured to paint my happiness on the wall. He lay as though finally convinced the wall was out of reach. And the swallows, he could no longer picture them. Last night, snow slid from the roof with a crash that shook the house. The footage flickers irresolutely on the screen. I watch from deep inside the winter of 2012. The snow drifts. The swallows don't move unless I do. So I'm going back a ways in this book now, just I don't even know what, 2003, for a couple of poems. One is springtime, which probably is up there with mermaids and hummingbirds as things you have to write about as a poet. I'm pretty good at covering those, I think, generally speaking, birds and flowers and trees. And it's in, it's sort of like each stanza is one line, and if you can sort of see across the page there. Springtime. It's a love poem between a maple tree and a car. The maples woo the car, its hood covered in pollen. Nature attempts the impossible yet again, the only way it knows of coping with a dead end. Longing wants to fuse with use. What's a white Volvo to do? Without genetics, without family or anyone to follow it home? Pollen under the windshield wipers, in all the intimate corners. It's pure engine. Can't think except in the past tense of fossil fuels. Who's to say nature can't turn it into something more? There's no better time or place. If there's any more luck in the world, let it find its way here. And then there's another little one that I've become fond of that I never used to read at all. I don't know why suddenly it's attached itself to me, but it has. Maybe it's because, actually, now that I think of it, I started doing work in philosophy a while ago, and this kind of addresses itself to that. Philosophers, some of them, like to talk about necessary and sufficient conditions, and that's sort of the starting place for this poem, which is called Roses. I really am racking them up. Roses. Not because it is sufficient, but because we subsist on light. And what doesn't cry out to be noticed? There's something here you might recognize, but you're not sure. Still, you're willing to risk it. The loss is of everything, seen and unseen, the before and the after. It doesn't depend on you, but you move toward it. Because as long as there's a moment here or there, why not arrange a few roses in a jar? Give thought to their listlessness. How they gather the room about them, yet think nothing of it. How each thorn persists. How they have made a purpose of holding still. Then you remember the necessary and sufficient. This isn't it, but you don't know where else to begin. So the philosophy work that I'm doing is on beauty, and I've been writing some poems that tackle beauty from one side or another, so I'll read a couple of those. This one started because I was reading an academic essay about beauty, and there's this little footnote, and in the footnote it said that there's an actual measure of beauty according to the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. Yeah. And the measure is the millihellen. And they define a millihellen as one millihellen being the amount of beauty it takes to launch exactly one ship. It was really too good to pass up. So that's the epigraph to this poem, which is called The Ends of the Earth. How many ships are launching today in this late September sun? How quickly do they run aground? And are they more beautiful as ruin, spilling gold over the road, which floods and thus lifts them up again, resurrected? This may have been what Ashbery meant by the double dream of spring. Only we're in autumn now, almost, mostly. And that way of talking, autumn, spring, maybe too simple for what's going on. We launch ships upon ships, failed attempts to reach the ends of the earth, the final amen. The dream doubled and redoubled in an even now, I hope, which I do, even now. Quixotic ship of fools setting out for visions, full sail, here in the complications, under the late millennial sun. I've also been trying. I'm going to let Sandra sit down. I've been trying to write these poems called Exercises in Beauty. It's not going very well. There are a lot on the cutting room floor, but I have two that are somewhat working now. So I'm going to read this one, which I haven't read before. It's in quite short lines, and it's Exercise in Beauty number one. A skeletal lace, cross-section of river foam. The spent leaf hangs from its stalk, worn down to the seams. Oh, I'm going to stop, because there's a word here that you might not know, and it's kind of important for the poem. The word is virga, which, if you don't know, means a rain that disappears before it hits the ground. Okay, back to the top. A skeletal lace. Cross-section of river foam. The spent leaf hangs from its stalk, worn down to the seams. Cobweb shadow, 2 summers old, on the brink of disappearing. A virga. What does it mean, this leaf? What does it say? That there's life in death? In, not after. Imagine such a life, its bareness, as the wind blows through the lattice, without a physic, at the mercy of, yes, unresolved even now. So stay your hand a moment. Let the mineral in your blood settle. Could you be swept up? Like dust, I mean. Like dust. Like the leaf, dangling from its branch, undone, unto. The frailest thread possible. Hang from it. Oh. You hanging in there? This one I find hard to read, but people seem to enjoy it, so I keep trying. and it's after photograph, and I brought in a book that has the photograph in it. So the photographer is Nan Golden. Who's known for taking these very intimate photographs of her close friends. Often they don't have a lot of clothes on. And this one is, let's see. It's called Paula Laughing on the Beach. I think that's actually the title of the photograph, too. So you won't be able to see anything at all, probably, from here, but I'll just pass it around. They're after an artwork, and I would hope that it does, but it's always nice to see it, right? Okay, so it's a prose poem, Powell Laughing on the Beach. Powell has just come out of the freezing winter sea, has put on his pants, and stands, chest bare, in a warm reddish light. His arms are crossed protectively over his chest, but his head's thrown back, like a madman laughing. The devil in him tempting fate. Oh, his radiant skin, the ripple of bones, his chest and arms, his sweet neck. Oh, the soft hairs clustered at his navel. He's doing a favor for his friend Nan, who's always taking these pictures. And because of her, and because of the salt and the sun, he's feeling so good, he doesn't care that the world will eventually pound him to dust, and that it's battering him even now. The sun's delicious, and he doesn't give a damn about anything else. So birth and death shrug their shoulders and relinquish their hold on him. This life and the one afterward want each other. They do. We can feel them trembling, as Powell is trembling after the cold, cold sea. Feel the tug as they strain to come together and are forced apart. It's impossible, except in instances like this. Powell's arms crossed in memory of suffering while he laughs in delight. His body turned daringly to the camera, dead on. For he has opened his heart to the blood of its next existence, even as it pumps in his chest. Somehow, he has stepped into another life, straddles them both. And he's a glee, getting away with this for even a split second. After all, he didn't seek it out, can't be blamed for this glitch in the mechanics. And the lens will be refocused in the next second anyway, as it must be. For if it went on, well, it can't go on. It just can't. So another one from this book that I haven't read before. It is not a hopeful poem. In the Long Afternoons. The sky looks down with a missionary gleam. The apple trees rise into bloom. Zealously, they rush into the breach, urge themselves to carry on, do more, as the lengthening summer days catch up with them. They ripen until they can ripen no more, striving to split themselves off from their shadows. But the earth tilts on its axis, and, sick with fruit, the branches soften under the straightforward, steady pressure of existence. They droop, and wasps stew in the carrion mush. All was more than we can bear. Sooner or later, even memory is taken, and we're not sure what remains. All we know is that the day is darker. And something has had its fill. So, there are two more. I think I'll still read two more. This one's in three parts. I will pause significantly between parts, so you will know. And I think that's all you need to know. It's called The Dead. I really like this theme of fulfilling all the poetic cliches. The Dead. This morning, the obdurate golden green grass, blurred with dew, buried in the house's shadow. Deer, their faces softened by sleep, raise their heads and look through you, draining you of motive. You become as still as they are, waiting, as though under it all lurked another, more comprehensible world, carrying itself so slowly as to go unnoticed. What if the dead don't leave? Not exactly. What if instead they're what orients you? The sixth sense that turns you this way and that, Tilt your face toward the light. What if they are the light? That would explain, wouldn't it, the strange clarity after someone dies. The peculiar radiance things acquire, even the least of them. Your loss everywhere transformed. Your suffering grown impersonal, self-sufficient. Each item buzzes with the vibrancy of the one who's gone. An inherited light that is no longer his or hers, that only you still recognize. So every time you close your eyes, something of that person leaves again. Let's be clear about the stillness you felt in the deer this morning. And yes, you're still staring, still feel the lukewarm glass against your forehead as you think of the dew and of the grass and of the deer themselves now vanished from the lawn. It had nothing to do with the dead. The dead don't stop with their hearts in their throats. To die is not to wash through the body of a deer like a ghost. It isn't to skulk under a living skin. It's a change in the value of things. There's no such thing as the dead. When the dead die, they don't hold anything back. Otherwise, a bitterness, like the sediment in wine. It's pure alchemy. The world pours itself into the vessel of the new day, and the liquid runs clear. And that's what hurts, the clarity. It leaves you staring out the window, wondering what to forgive. The lawn more beautiful than it should be. Blades of grass all bent one way, silvered and utterly coherent, like a mirror with no face in it. Let's see, this one has a little bit of a narrative in it, so it's nice for a change. And it has a reference to the painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel with God and Adam reaching out for one another. And it's called Fear of Wasps. He tried to explain it to me, how his friend fell off his bike and broke his clavicle after a wasp flew up his shirt and stung him repeatedly, continuing to sting him even after he'd fallen into the ditch and lay in the dirt howling, while my friend laughed at him, doubled over, unable to clasp his friend's outstretched hand. The story told me almost nothing about wasps, but his failure to grasp his friend's hand puts me in mind of Adam's finger, almost but not quite touching God's. And perhaps the wasps are somehow the embodiment of the space between those two hands, that inch of not being. They are the gap my friend fears in the world, flying zeros, buzzing nihilists. Their carrion-loving bodies, a lacuna, carried from one day into the next. It's not a fear of being stung, but of being stung and reaching out and finding nothing there. For he loved his friend, but despised him in equal measure. And the gap between these things he cannot account for. Thanks a lot.